Hey Fixers, we've got a special treat for you this week. Students from the University of Oregon's Clark Honors College will be joining us as guest hosts to interview luminaries from around the state of Oregon who are working on innovative fixes in our state. Without further ado, here's the episode.
This is Fix It, and I'm your co-host, Mindy Tran. I'm a second-year data science and bio major at the University of Oregon.
And I'm your co-host, Delaney Kleiner. I'm a junior at the University of Oregon, and I'm double majoring in environmental science and biology.
Today, we are addressing the value of sacrifice in American culture and politics. We are here with Andrew Kallik. After graduating Harvard Law School, he joined the ACLU as an attorney, living in New York. Andrew then went on to work as a policy advisor in the office of Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer, and then became deputy policy advisor to Comptroller Stringer upon his election to office in 2013. Andrew is currently working in global and public policy at Airbnb, where he works with cities and towns to foster responsible home sharing. We are so happy to have Andrew here with us today. Before we jump into things, I wanted to preface that we wanted to talk to Andrew about his Oregon Way article on the value of sacrifice. He mentions that the language of sacrifice is lost in politics, but it can be a very motivating value to rally people across the political spectrum, as well as geographic and racial lines. Now let's get to the interview.
So can you just kind of introduce this topic to our listeners, the language of sacrifice, and how it can be motivating to rally people together?
Absolutely. And thank you, Mindy and Delaney, for having me. It's great to be with you. The language of sacrifice is something that throughout American history, we've often lauded as a great virtue. We think about the great speeches of presidential history, John Kennedy asking not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. We think about the Gettysburg Address with Abraham Lincoln, calling upon the dead soldiers at Gettysburg for having given their lives to a Union that's up by and for the people. We think about, you know, storming the beaches of Normandy and those sacrifices, not only by the individuals, some of whom are barely out of high school, who confronted Nazi Germany, but their families back home and the communities that their families were a part of, doing what they could to contribute to a collective effort. And so we have this in American history as part of our sort of cultural zeitgeist. And yet in recent years, and my article goes into this a little bit, we've seen continued sort of decline in the language of sacrifice, literally how often people use the term sacrifice. But I think more importantly, how often our leaders call for it, call for us to take part as individuals and communities in a collective action to solve a collective problem. And the reason why I think this is such a huge deal right now is that if you look at the problems that we face as a state, country, world in 2021, they are collective problems by and large. They are less and less individual problems. They demand collective action. This is climate change. This is housing. This is criminal justice reform, economic development, trade. You go all the way down the line. And so if people see themselves as individuals first, rather than members of all sorts of different communities to which they have both obligations, duties, responsibilities, then I think solving those collective problems is going to be extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible. And that's why I've called for people, particularly our leaders, to have the courage of their conviction and to actually say to constituents, to rally them behind this idea of sacrifice as a means to motivate action.
And so in that argument, do you think that the leaders in Oregon are specifically not calling on constituents because of the polarization in Oregon? Do you think that those are a direct relationship to one another?
That's a great question. I don't know. I think polarization creates many problems. One of which is that if we don't see ourselves as part of a common community, then we are less likely to see each other as sacrificing for the other. In other words, if Republicans see Democrats as fundamentally distinct from themselves and vice versa, then if I'm in Ontario, what do I care if somebody in Portland is, you know, sacrificing on my behalf? I certainly might not see it that way. And similarly, you know, someone in Eugene seeing someone in Coos Bay doing the same. So I think you're onto something there. But like many other things, I'm not sure I entirely know the answer to that question. I do think that in Oregon, our leaders, by and large, have not leveraged the language of sacrifice effectively. We have seen in recent weeks, and we're taping this at the beginning of May in 2021, when the coronavirus pandemic is still ongoing, we've seen in recent weeks some Oregon leaders saying, get your vaccination, do it for your family, do it for your community. But there are also signs that that might not be working, and that that language might not be powerful enough, might not be directed enough to actually get people to step in and take that that action. And so I do think that there is room for improvement, and there's room for people to talk about sacrifice in lots of different ways and to reach different audiences in different ways, depending on who you're talking to and what the issue is.
Definitely. And I think that the graphic that you included in your article in the Oregon Way that showed the use of the word sacrifice over time clearly indicated a sharp decline since, you know, right before 1850 until now. And I'm expecting that in the presence of COVID-19, we're going to see that word resurface more. But perhaps that big gap is making it what's so hard for constituents to sacrifice, because there's been such a long time period of, you know, a decline of that word and perhaps a decline of what that means. Do you think that that could be why perhaps the messages surrounding COVID-19 are not effective today?
I think that's a great point. And I do think that we lack the type of very clear, discrete examples that were broadly shared that maybe we America had in 1950 or 1960. I included a quote, you know, everybody knows the Kennedy quote about asking what you can do for your country. Very few people know, same election, Richard Nixon, Republican on the other side, Kennedy's challenger, said essentially the same thing when he accepted the nomination. He said, we have to sacrifice, not the sacrifice that leads us to destitution. It's the sacrifice that leads us to collective action. And why was he able to say that? And why were Republicans and Democrats equally motivated by that? Well, probably because they didn't have to look far to see examples of how in the entire country had done this in the recent past. The Korean War, World War II, the Depression. Like, this is a very concentrated time of sacrifice and collective sacrifice. And so when you use that word, it was almost sort of self-defined. People knew what Nixon was talking about. People knew what Kennedy was talking about. Now, maybe it's less clear, right? I mean, I grew up, and I'll date myself as an old millennial. I grew up in the 1990s. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Cold War was over. This was the Pax Americana. Everyone was going to be rich. Everything was going to be peaceful. There were no major global conflicts. And maybe as a result, again, we sort of thought this was the end of history, to use another historian's term. We didn't have to think about the collective action problems again. But obviously, the 21st century has sort of snapped us directly back into out of that daze, and given us a real sense that we do have to think about what it means. Now, what it means might not be the same as what it meant in 1940 and 1950. And what it means may not be the same for every single person. You know, I think it's very important, because when I talk to people about this, they say, well, you know, there are folks out there who are living paycheck to paycheck. They can barely make it. Why? How dare you, a relatively comfortable person, ask them to sacrifice? And that's a legitimate question to ask. But the nature of sacrifice, and you can go back to the holy text for this, but you can also go back to sort of presidential addresses, is that everyone gives what she can to the collective effort. If you have a lot, you're expected to give a lot. If you might not have any money, but you can pick up a shovel and dig a ditch. I mean, there's no one specific thing, but that collective action and that belief that if we all come together to sort of perform this sort of common task, that we can achieve more, I think is very, very valuable. And the reason why I think it's particularly valuable today is we read every day about the sort of crisis of loneliness, not only in the United States, but abroad, about how people feel atomized. They don't feel like they're part of institutions. We've seen a decline in church going. We've seen a decline in membership of civic organizations like the Lions Club, right? And it all contributes to people grasping for a purpose, a collective purpose. Humans are a social species, even the shy among us. And so to the extent that leaders can leverage that very sort of human need for good rather than for ill, and we see the ill, and we can talk a little bit about how some groups try to exploit this for ill, then we're all going to be better off. And so that's a long-winded answer to your question, but I think we're at a moment where we can come up with a new definition and use it to motivate.
In your article, you also mentioned that there is just a general unwillingness for individual Americans to make sacrifices. And you specifically mentioned like things like paying higher taxes. So how would you reframe the language around sacrifice to motivate people to make those individual sacrifices?
Yeah, it's pretty stark, right? On the one hand, the polling says, yeah, we should make sacrifices, sometimes even big sacrifices. As you noted, people think that across the political spectrum. They think in rural America and urban America. And then you say, well, how about these specific sacrifices that you can make? And they say, oh, no. And I think one reason why there is that response is that we have seen a rise in fundamental distrust between Americans. If you trust that your neighbor will be an upstanding citizen and make a similar or even greater sacrifice than you to solve that collective problem, then you're going to answer that question absolutely. Because if I make that sacrifice, I know that the person across the street, down the block, they're going to make the same one too. But right now, and Secretary Buttigieg, Transportation Secretary, has a new book out about trust and the decline of trust in not only American institutions, but in each other. If you don't think that the person down the block is going to pull their weight, if you especially don't think that those who are wealthy and privileged are going to pull their weight, then you're going to say, no. I'm not. Don't ask me to do that when the billionaires of the world aren't pulling their weight. That is a completely understandable perspective to have. And it's one I respect. It's one I understand. And I don't know what the answer is to chip away at it. But I do think that you have to chip away at it. It's not one solution that's going to solve this entirely. It's let's start small, maybe on your block, maybe in your local community, as opposed to the federal government, and say, look, we have a very discrete project here. This is what we are going to be asking of various people. You can contribute in lots of different ways, give people lots of options. So if they don't want to, or they don't feel like they can throw in $50 on a project, but they can throw in an hour of sweat equity, they can do that, right? So you give people different sort of doors to take action collectively. And that in and of itself builds trust. Just one more story on this. My grandfather was a member of one of those sort of famed New Deal programs, the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC. He grew up in a small Massachusetts town, not diverse in really any respect. And yet all of a sudden here he was as a member of the CCC, as a young man, thrown together with people from lots of different backgrounds from all over the country to solve collective problems, namely, in his case, building trails through national parks. And, you know, I never got to meet the man, but my grandfather, Louis Araldi, I know, sort of passed on the lesson of that sort of collective sacrifice to my mother, who was a public school teacher and involved in civic life her entire life, the notion that you have to contribute. Look inside yourself to see what you can do. And again, it might not be the same as your neighbor, but you can lead by example by pitching in. And so I think we need to create more opportunities for Americans to do the types of collective work that my grandfather was lucky enough to have the chance to do.
Following up on that story, how do you think that message that your grandfather passed on and that your mother has passed on to you, how has that shaped your perspective on life, perhaps what career you've pursued?
It has been the foundational principle of my life, to it's no exaggeration. And that's an amazing thing. This is my mother's father died decades before I was born. And yet you can see how seeds planted generations earlier can come home to roost in family values and, again, commitment to this idea of being part of a larger community. And so from my earliest days, listening to my father rant and rave at the Sunday political talk shows when we got home from church, I've been interested in politics and civic affairs and see it as just an absolutely essential component of our collective existence. And it doesn't mean it's the only way people can contribute. I want to make that very clear. There are lots of ways to contribute. When an artist puts up a mural in downtown Eugene and it's appreciated by everybody who walks by, that is an extraordinary sharing of talent. And you know, the list goes on and on. I just use that as an example. But for me, it's always been sort of motivated toward civic affairs, the challenging questions that we all face, the challenging problems that we face collectively, and trying to think through just how can we motivate ourselves and one another to rise to the challenge that those present.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that story with us. It's kind of a side note, but we learned about the asymmetry of trust. And that kind of sounds like something that you were talking about with the book Numbers and Nerves by the Slovics. I'm not sure if you're familiar. But yeah, just the idea that trust is easy to lose,
yes,
hard to rebuild. Mm-hmm. And it definitely sounds like the concept that you were describing to us.
And I think you're absolutely right to say that. And that's why I think that it's very important to look for leaders in many corners of life, but particularly in government and politics, who appreciate the fact that it is hard to rebuild and that your page of history may not be the grand sort of moment where we all sing kumbaya and trust one another again, but instead you can get us a little bit closer. You can take a little step forward. And then maybe your daughter, I have a couple of daughters and I can say them taking it a little step forward too, right? And politics often sort of self-selects for grandiose, for ego, when what we really need to do collectively is select for people who are modest, who ground their motivation in the collective action, and who have the courage to ask people, as Kennedy did, to do their part.
You mentioned there's party vote unity in Congress and like that kind of,
yeah,
and how politicians are lagging behind in terms of valuing sacrifice. Since politicians are lagging behind, do you think that there should be some instances where we should make bigger strides? Or do you think that continuous, smaller, incremental growth is like where we should keep going?
So this is a very complicated question, but I think it has a simple answer, which is that, as I mentioned earlier, there are lots of different roles that people play as citizens. Elected leaders get a lot of attention, but that's just one role. Think about the roles that advocates have played and are playing in the American experience. Advocates rarely get out in the street with a banner that says incremental progress now, right? That's not going to get people in the street. And it's not going to change the way we imagine a world of possibility. The advocate in our system of government is going to push, sometimes push for revolutionary change, to use Senator Sanders' language, right? And I think that's great. And I think it's necessary for people to do that. I think that if you're talking about legislative leaders, though, if you're talking about the very discrete job of figuring out how in an incredibly diverse democracy like ours in America, and even in Oregon, how to pass laws that solve problems, that sort of bring together people of different views, that requires a respect for the revolutionary moonshot, but also a deep in the weeds understanding that sometimes moving the ball, to use the sports analogy, moving the ball a yard down the field is better than just, you know, keeping it in the same place. And I know that that is difficult for people to accept, and they shouldn't accept it. You should keep pushing, right? But we should also recognize that democracy is so much bigger than all of us, and the communities that we are a part of go far beyond our sort of short lives on this planet. And so we need to at least be cognizant of the fact that sometimes incremental change, while not everything we want or expect or deserve, is the best we can get at any given moment. So that's really what I mean about that. There will be moments in your life when you face sort of revolutionary periods of time. This might be one of them, given the tumult that COVID has generated in the world. But I think having some historical perspective about that long arc of history, as King would have said, is very important for us as well as citizens.
It's almost like it takes a great push to just unbudge the society we're in to move that one yard. It sounds like that's kind of the message you're giving to us here. Would you agree?
I think so. And sometimes, you know, you're going to go 10 yards, you're going to throw that deep pass, and then you're going to take a few steps back, and that's fine too. Again, it's not that we limit our ambition to incrementalism. We don't. We seek the world that we believe is right and just, a world where people have the right to live a life where they can exercise freedom of speech and religion and be free from hunger and fear, as Roosevelt would have said, and to have those rights be applied no matter what the color of your skin, the content of your character, the location of your birth. So it's not that we don't aspire to that, just as we don't aspire to the moonshot in the 60s. It's just that we do, I think, collectively have to understand that sometimes you take small steps before you run. Maybe that's the best analogy for Eugenians, given their love of running. But it's important to recognize that. And to be honest, we recognize that in our own lives, right? Like when you sit down and do an assignment for a class, you know, your work on that assignment is not all of a sudden going to revolutionize everything in your life. But you understand that that assignment is one piece of a broader effort that you are undergoing to open yourself and your mind up to the world and share with the world the insights that you have. And so I think we recognize it in our own lives, we just have to recognize it in our collective life as well.
Definitely. And as we only have a few minutes remaining, I'm wondering if we can zoom in specifically here to Oregon. How do you see your solution operating here in Oregon? What do you think a future would look like if sacrifices are made, or the process of that?
Yeah. Again, I don't pretend to have all the answers on this. And I would love to hear feedback from folks who tune into this podcast, read the article, have ideas of their own, because this is, it's a collective problem, demands collective solutions. I don't have all of them by any stretch. But I will say that one of the things about Oregon right now, and you alluded to this earlier, Delaney, with your question about polarization, is that we are divided in many respects. Sometimes it's party, sometimes it's region. I'm looking out my window at the Coast Range, and sometimes you would think that those mountains are, you know, 40,000 feet high, the way people on the coast think about people in the valley and vice versa. And so to the extent that we can start to rebuild bonds between and across geographies and identities and parties, I think the better off we will be. In other words, look for those opportunities for collective action that span difference. So that instead of just thinking we know something about the people across the Coast Range, instead of just thinking that we know, oh, you know, yeah, those people in Portland, we actually work with them side by side on something that brings benefits to the broader community. So that's sort of one aspect. The second is that we can do things in Oregon, structural things with our democracy, to make electing independent-minded, courageous officials more likely than it currently is. And yet, right now, the way we elect officials in Oregon is what we have, for instance, closed primaries. So only Democrats can vote for Democrats in the primary, only Republicans can vote for Republicans. That's a vicious cycle that leads to polarization. And it leads to people who, the more they toe the party line, the more likely they are to be able to get on the ballot. We should change that. There's no reason to have closed primaries, especially not as the numbers clearly indicate that in the last several years, non-affiliated voters, by far the greatest source of growth here in Oregon, and that those non-affiliated voters tend to be young, they tend to be lower income, they tend to be less white. So what are we going to do? If we're really about equity, if we're really about building a democracy that is inclusive and supports independent thought, we're going to open up our primaries and we're going to say, let's be a big tent state where everybody is respected and that we elect people who are as independent as Oregon itself.
Yeah, I think the statistic that you mentioned in your article about how to be anti-partisan was mind-blowing to me, that almost 1 in 3 registered voters fall into that non-affiliated group.
I think we're up to 35% now, even since that article came out. So yeah, it continues to rise. And so, you know, Oregon likes to toot its own horn when it comes to our voting process, our all-male voting process, right? And it is, it's great. We should be proud of that. But we've got some work to do if we want to shore up things on our end as well.
Yeah, I especially find it really surprising that you mentioned that Oregon is just one of 9 states that has closed primaries. And I don't know if that changed, but like that one really hit me because it seems like Oregon prides itself on being so progressive, but it's like 1 of 9.
You know, structural changes alone aren't going to fix this. Like I said, it's important for leaders to have the courage of their convictions, to go to their constituents and say, this is a problem. It needs solving. I can't solve it alone. Everybody needs to get on board with what you can do, but the structural issues are significant and they can be addressed.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It's been really interesting to chat with you about this. And I found both of your articles compelling and wonderful and inspiring.
I appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Andrew Kallick, for taking time out of your day to just come talk with us and join us on the Fix It podcast. And just to kind of wrap up, how can our listeners help you out if you're talking about the value of sacrifice or otherwise?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Andrew Kallick, my name. Email me, andrewkallick@gmail.com. And a plug for a group that I'm a part of here in Eugene, the Eugene City Club. We put on events of civic importance every week. So a little sacrifice would be taking an hour a week to listen to some of our panels, see what people are facing, not only in Eugene, but throughout the region. And importantly, as we do in each of those panels, think about what you can do, what part you might have in solving some of these problems, because we need everybody. Thanks so much for the time, and thanks so much for your work and for your interest in these issues. It's critically important.
Again, thank you to Andrew Kallick for joining us on the show. Please use #fixer to tell us about problems you're solving in your neck of the woods. And tweet us at @fix_cast. If you enjoyed today's show or any of our other episodes, please show us some love and leave us a 5-star review. It would really make our day. Until next time, fixers!